Good afternoon and welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this Thursday, March 18th. Our first item is the call of the roll to establish a quorum. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Hornstein, present. Vice Chair Cagle.
Present.
Cagle, present. Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Barr.
Here.
Barr, present. Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Frederick, present. Representative Hausman.
Present.
Hausman, present. Representative Heinrich.
Present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Nelson, present. Representative Olson.
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Richardson.
Present.
Richardson, present. Representative Torkelson.
Present.
Torkelson, present. Representative West.
Present.
West, present. There is a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge. Our next item of business is the approval of the minutes from March 16th, 2021. Representative Petersburg, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move approval of the March 16th minutes for this committee.
The motion to approve is before us. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails. Members, we have five bills on our agenda today. I'm pretty confident we can get done by 2:30, but if not, we do have airtime reserved for us to complete our agenda, and we will either reconvene at 5 if that's necessary, or if session goes long, 20 minutes past the session. So our first item of business in terms of bills is House File 1199. Representative Cleavorn, welcome to the committee. Nice to see you back again. And this motion will be to send House File 1199 to the committee, to a re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. So welcome, Representative Cleavorn, and please let us know about your bill. I know you do have an amendment as well, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Ignition interlock is the focus of this bill, House File 1199, and it's currently used in Minnesota for DWI offenders. The bill before us today has broad bipartisan support, and moreover, there is broad public support for the use of ignition interlock for convicted DWI drivers. The goal of this legislation is to reduce the number of drunk driving incidents and to decrease recidivism rates. Under the current law, a person whose driver's license is canceled for a third DWI or more, excuse me, let me try that again. A driver's license is canceled for a third or more DWIs in a 10-year period or a fourth DWI in a person's life. Those individuals must then participate in the ignition interlock program to be eligible for license reinstatement. This bill expands an ignition interlock requirement for reinstatement for individuals whose license have been revoked for a second DWI in 10 years or a third DWI in a person's life. And we're just general information. Both Representative Poston and Representative O'Neill provided support and recommendations to improve this legislation. The provision that with their support that was included requires the manufacturers of certified devices to pay for any towing or repair cost caused by device failure or malfunction. In your packets today, you will find letters of support from the Minnesota DWI Task Force, Mothers Against Drunk Driving's National Office, the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association, as well as the Coalition of Ignition Interlock Manufacturers. While I've learned a great deal about Ignition Interlock, I'm going to limit my comments there as we have experts with us today who can speak to the public good of Ignition Interlock. Mr. Chair, would you like to address the A4 amendment at this time?
Yes, please. If you could, I'll move the A4 amendment. And if you could let the committee know the contents of the amendment.
The A4 amendment is the appropriation language for this bill. And in speaking with the best way to address the appropriation, this method was devised. $537,000 would be appropriated in 2022, $390,000 in fiscal year 2023, and these are appropriated from the Driver Services Operation account in the Special Revenue Fund to the Commissioner of Public Safety for this Ignition Interlock program. It is a one-time appropriation.
Members, is there discussion or questions about the A4 amendment? Seeing none, we will, Representative Petersburg, please proceed. Question to the author?
Well, yeah, that, or maybe even Mr. Burris, just, I would like a little bit more explanation. It seems like that's, like the amendment is still a little bit more complicated than that. I don't know exactly what I'm asking for. It just seems like there's a lot of words and changes in it, and maybe Mr. Burris can kind of...
Well, thank you, Representative Petersburg. I think that's helpful, and Representative Cleaborn, I think we can have either Mr. Burris and or Mr. Lee from Nonpartisan Research and Fiscal Staff maybe familiarize the committee a little bit more with the fiscal piece of this. That's one of the reasons. There's both policy and finance reasons why this bill is before us in the Transportation Committee. Do you want to start, Mr. Burris, or is this kind of more of a Mr. Lee issue?
Mr. Chair, I might start.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, I think you might be looking at the A5 amendment, which has some additional proposals around DWI-related activities. The A4 amendment just contains the one-time appropriations for fiscal years 2022 and 23.
My mistake. That is the one I was looking at. So sorry about that. I missed the numbers. Sorry about that. So I will.
Well, that's okay.
Eliminate my objection for this one, and raise it for the other.
Well, thank you, Representative Petersburg. Well, it's still good that Mr. Burris was able to clarify what's in the A4 as well. So, is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, and the A4 is successfully incorporated. Representative Cleaborn, did you want to start with any testifiers or discuss the bill further as amended?
Mr. Chair, I think it's best if we just move on to Mr. David Bernstein, who is the chair of the Minnesota DWI Task Force. I would ask you to recognize him at this.
Yes. Mr. Bernstein, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chair of Minnesota's DWI Task Force. The DWI Task Force submitted a letter in support of House File 1199. I won't reiterate the contents of that letter, but just emphasize that ignition interlock is a proven method to keep our highways safe, especially for alcohol-based offenses. This expansion would address repeat offenders, which are the more serious offenders. And so the DWI Task Force believes that this is a good expansion of ignition interlock and would respectfully urge the committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Bernstein? Representative Petersburg, your hand is up. I don't know if that's still from last time.
It's just from last time. Sorry about that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Thank you for your work with the task force as well. Representative Cleaver, I believe you have another testifier, Mr. Ott.
Miss Ott.
Miss, I'm sorry. Didn't get that right. I apologize. Ms. Ott, please welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to testify today in support of House File 1199. My name is Alex Ottie, and I am the national president of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. When I was 13 years old, I was run over by a drunk boater. I was sitting on a jet ski behind my dad's house on Lake Harrington in Danville, Kentucky, across the narrow lake, about 40 yards, my mom and brothers, they were docking our boat. I was waiting for them to finish so that I could dock the jet ski and we could go up to the house. There was a 17-foot fast boat coming under a nearby bridge, and I gave my mom a thumbs up to let her know I saw him coming and I wasn't going to move. The boat was headed towards my mom and my brother. My mom screamed. The boat banked it to the left and never straightened up. He hit me from the side, going over 60 miles an hour, threw me off the jet ski. The boat went up over the jet ski and came down on top of my body. I sustained very severe injuries, including a traumatic brain injury, classified as shaken baby syndrome, a broken jaw, a broken neck, a broken collarbone, a lacerated liver, and bilateral shattered femurs. I now have metal rods in place of bone in both of my thighs. When the boat came down on top of me, the propeller landed on my legs. My left leg was under the water enough that it only required stitches, but my right leg was completely severed by the propeller. The man who ran me over was three times over legal limit, 2.5 hours later. Months later, I sat in a wheelchair in a courtroom while the man who changed my life forever denied any wrongdoing. He was charged $250 and left to walk out and reoffend, and he has multiple times. I had 8 emergency surgeries in the first 7 days and so many more in the years since. I spent a week in a coma, several weeks in the ICU, 6 weeks in a neck brace, and several months in a wheelchair. To absolutely no fault of my own, this was my new life. The only thing that would have changed that crash is if he hadn't been drunk. House File 1199 will put life-saving ignition interlocks in the cars of repeat offending drunk drivers. Mothers Against Drunk Driving and myself personally support this legislation as it is an improvement to the impaired driving law and will hold accountable those who continue to make this deadly choice. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, MAD urges you to please advance House File 1199. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing your very moving story, and I've appreciated for many years the work of MAD and keeping everybody safe, and appreciate your being here and your support for this bill. Thank you so much. Representative Cleaver, did you were there some additional testifiers? I know there's others that are available for questions.
No, Mr. Chair, those are the only testifiers we have, but we do have other experts who are with us if we do have questions that require their participation.
And we also have an A5 amendment, but is that still going to be offered, Representative Cagle?
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not going to offer the amendment on the time. I want to keep working on the language.
Okay. That's good to know. Thank you for that. So, Representative Petersburg, I think you may have another different opportunity to ask your questions about the A5 amendment. So is there discussion to the bill and any additional questions of any of the authors or the testifiers that have been with us today? Okay, I don't see any. Representative Cleaver, do you have any additional concluding comments to your very important bill?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, I would just say to you, your yes vote is saying yes to having safer roadways and protecting our families. And with that, I would just ask for your support.
Okay, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1199, as amended, be referred to the committee, re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Mr. Dodge, would you please take the roll?
Chair Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Vice Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Aye.
Petersburg, aye. Representative Barr?
Aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hausman?
Aye.
Hausman, aye. Representative Heinrich?
Aye.
Heinrich, aye. Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Kosnick, aye. Representative Mason? Representative Mason? Representative Mason? Representative Murphy?
Murphy, aye.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Torkelson?
Aye.
Torkelson, aye. Representative West?
Aye.
West, aye. There are 16 ayes and 0 nays.
There being 16 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails. The bill, as amended, House File 1199, is on its way to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so much, Representative Cleavorn, for this bill and to the testifiers. We really appreciate your hard work on this important issue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, testifiers. Have a great day.
Thank you. So, members, our next bill on the agenda is House File 985, coming from Representative Torkelson. And I did want to preface this by saying, you know, as one of the people that helped shepherd the original Corridors of Commerce legislation, I appreciate all of the hard work that Representative Torkelson has done over the years in addressing some of the updating some of the criteria for this bill. Or for this program. You know, I think his support for the overall concept has been very much appreciated over the years. And like any initiatives, I think this the program does need to be revisited. There needs to be some revisions. You know, I know this specific bill has some specific amount set aside for this. I'm not necessarily in agreement with that specific figure, but I do appreciate the scrutiny that this is receiving from Representative Torkelson and others. I know that he has been, and if you wanted to comment on this, Representative Torkelson, you're welcome to. I know that you have also been looking at criteria and other aspects of this program that you're working with people at MnDOT and ongoing meetings with them. And I'm very interested in that and very supportive of your efforts in that. So. This is just one facet of the Corridors of Commerce program, and I'm very interested in hearing your ideas, Representative Torkelson, and I appreciate your bringing this bill forward. So the motion is going to be to lay over House File 985 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and please proceed with your testimony, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing this bill to come before the committee. House File 958, as you said, does involve corridors of commerce and actually sets aside funds from the Trunk Highway Fund for corridors of commerce. The figure is 10%. I contacted Mr. Lee, who came back with some estimated numbers. That'd be some over $300 million a year going into corridors of commerce. Corridors of Commerce has had a kind of a bumpy ride through its history. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for your work in initiating the program originally. And it's served many parts of the state quite well. Our last go around with corridors got pretty involved with the project evaluation and creating a project priority list. That required a lot of work from the Department of Transportation to assemble. And after its assembly, the first allocations were quite controversial, honestly. So yes, you're right, Mr. Chair. I am looking at the Corridors of Commerce program in hopes of finding ways to make it viable and valuable for the future. This bill also does contain some language regarding the priorities of Corridors of Commerce. It adds one new
priority and also an instruction that all priorities be given equal weight. The new one really is to try and address the issue of some projects that came to corridors that really weren't totally scoped. And when they were scoped, it revealed a much higher price tag than what has originally been conceived when the project was first authorized in corridors. So with that, Mr. Chair, I really do thank you for hearing this issue. It's an issue that I am working on. It's kind of a bit of a work in progress. This bill has been heard in the Senate, so I'm expecting the issue may come up as you work your way through the process of getting a final bill before us. So I think it's worthy of discussion. I do believe that the department has some comments today, and I welcome them or other questions from members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. And let's start the discussion among committee members, and then we'll turn to MnDOT. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The House research summary under the second item, modifies project selection, says require that statutorily listed selection criteria are given equal weight except for regional balance throughout the state. What would be the point of that exception?
Well, this language was developed actually on the Senate side of the street, but I believe that is a result of the last allocation of funds, and that many felt that the regional balance was not there when a number of projects right around the northwest part of the Twin Cities got funded. MnDOT used the metropolitan district as covering the entire metro when we all, many of us believe that the metropolitan district really far exceeds in size just the 7-county metro that is included in the department's district. That resulted in a number of projects being kind of all coming from one area in the state, and that being that northwest corner of the Twin Cities, which reached out with projects along Interstate 94 that is technically by the department's evaluation in greater Minnesota. So I think the idea is that we give greater attention to a regional balance that reaches across all corners of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, when the department's up there, I would be interested in hearing from them whether language like that could have unintended consequences in the final selection.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. And yes, after we hear from Representative Heinrich, Elkins, and Kosnick, I will call up MnDOT, and also we have Shane Zark from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities lined up to testify. But these are good questions for the author and for committee discussion at this time. Representative Heinrich, you're next in line.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question's for Representative Torkelson or possibly staff, but I was just wondering when it comes to the criteria, one of the selection criteria modes is support and consensus for the project among members of the surrounding community. I was just wondering if that has anything to do with local municipalities or counties putting money, injecting money into a trunk highway. Does that weigh in inside of that selection criteria? Or maybe another one would be the return on investment measures that provide for comparison across eligible projects. We would have a greater ROI possibly if a county or a municipality, put some first money into some of those projects. Just wondering if that factors in at all in the corridors of commerce criteria. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson, do you think
I'll take
it, MnDOT, or do you want to take that?
I'll be happy to take a shot at it first, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The criteria you refer to, Representative, are really the criteria that were developed prior to the 2017 transportation bill. These are in existence in statute today, and they are the criteria the department used when they created the priority list that was used that year. As far as how they interpreted those, that really was up to the department, and I'd be happy to hear from the department's perspective on this.
I believe Mr. Rudin is with us. Mr. Rudin, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. And to that specific question. I don't believe that a local contribution was necessarily scored in the last round, although, you know, typically if there's been work done by a local government to help get a project ready, that may, especially if we're adding project readiness to the criteria, that may help a project. You know, there are programs where that might be considered, like the Transportation Economic Development Program comes to mind, especially if there is a private sector contribution. There are limited cases where, you know, a private landowner might donate right of way, for example, and that could help a project score better. So there are instances where that's evaluated, but I don't believe that that's been done in the Corridors of Commerce program. I'll verify that though and get back to you if that's not the case, Representative Heinrich.
Representative Heinrich, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rudine. I think I'm good for now. It seems that one measure of maybe support and consensus from a community could possibly be input of local money into the trunk highway system. So just want to make that statement, not necessarily for or against it, just kind of an interesting just curiosity that I had. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, and Representative Heinrich, I have always appreciated your involvement in the Highway 10 issue. You know, I know we've met about that, and you graciously hosted the committee when we looked at that project last year. So I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Kind of thinking you're probably looking at through the prism of that issue as well. So I saw Representative Kosnick, then Representative Elkins, then I'd like to get to our testifiers. Representative Kosnick.
Would you mind going to Representative Elkins as I get back into my office here? Would that be all
sure.
right?
Sure. Thank I'm sure Representative Elkins won't mind that. Representative Elkins, ready to go?
I guess so. I was going to use his time to collect my thoughts, but that's okay. I think remembering back to the last Corridors of Commerce, I remember feeling some consternation myself about how all of the greater Minnesota projects happened to be located just outside the metro. But my consternation may have been a little bit different. It's that you know, those projects actually don't provide any benefit to anyone in the metro. They're there to provide greater access to the metro from people in greater Minnesota. And the location of those particular projects from the perspective of someone who lives in the metro is that they just fuel urban sprawl. So I just want to let Representative Torkelson know that I have some sympathy with him on that particular issue.
Well, here we have some Metro Rural Coalition building before our eyes. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Elkins, for your sympathy. I do appreciate it. I would perhaps not interpret highway building to and from the metro as benefiting only greater Minnesota. I believe it goes both ways. The metropolitan folks do need access to greater Minnesota. I think if you travel that road on any Friday night in the summertime, you'd find a lot of traffic going north and not so much coming into the metro at that point in time.
I will grant that point, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. We'll have Representative Kosnick's question, then we'll go to our two testifiers. Representative Kosnick, are you now well situated?
Hey, my laptop's still not launching, but that's okay. I apologize for not using
the video. We can hear you quite well.
Okay, great. I was just, maybe the House Research or the original author of Corridors of Commerce, the chair or Representative Torkelson, could give us a little background of why we have the criteria listed in the bill and the program and how they're weighted differently. I'm curious about that.
Representative Kosnick, unless Representative Torkelson wants to respond, I think that would probably be most appropriate for Mr. Rudine.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick. Yes, after some changes were made to the criteria, the legislature proactively made some changes to the criteria in statute, and Partly that was the result of a legislative audit on the commercial program. But after those changes were made, MnDOT did go through a fairly extensive public outreach process where we asked for and received public input on the various selection criteria that were identified in statute. And we asked the members of the public to help us decide how much weight to give to each of those various criteria that are listed. So for the bill that's today, we would have to give equal weight to each of those, except for, as Representative Hausman pointed out, geographic balance. But the process that was used in the last solicitation and evaluation was very much a public process where we got input from the public and from agencies like, you know, Department of Employment and Economic Development about some of the return on investment criteria that were used for projects.
Thank you. Did you want to follow up, President Kosnick?
Yeah, so it sounds like, you know, the criteria is listed for a reason to achieve the goals of the program. So my concern, Representative Perkelson, with all respect, is giving equal weight to all those criteria changes the intent of what the program was for. And then, you know, perhaps we should just delete all the criteria is really what kind of the effect of equaling them all out is. So have some reservations on that point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. I share some of your consternation regarding criteria. I don't know an exact number, but I know that when these criteria were developed and the department tried to implement them the way they stand in statute today, it took considerable time and effort. They even had to meet the timelines, even had to hire outside consultants at some significant expense. And I share your concerns about how criteria might work given this equal weight clause. It's the way the bill was presented to me. I think we really need to step back, reevaluate corridors. I think it is a valuable program. It's allowed us to fund some projects that otherwise weren't making it to the top of the heap, so to speak. But it honestly, I believe it needs work. And I think the department would agree. They have not produced, after they produced that original list of priorities, they have not updated the list or tried to create a new list. I think, and you'll have to see what they have to say, but I think in part because it was such a tremendous effort to create that list, given the criteria as they stand in statute today.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick, for your questions. Thank you, members, for all of your questions. We do have a couple for more formal testimony. I know that Mr. Udine had been available to answer some questions, but he's available. But I'd like to start off with Shane Zart from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities for some specific testimony to the bill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Well, thank you, Chair Hornstein and members. My name is Shane Zart with the firm Flaherty & Hood and represent the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And we've had a lot of great member discussions so far. So that kind of makes my job easy because I get to say ditto to a couple things instead of saying them for the first time. But I want to thank Representative Torkelson for bringing this bill forward, Chair Hornstein for hearing it. Both of you, as you discussed, have played a key role in the history of this program, both creating it and its past success. So what I think this bill does, and the major positive about having this before the committee today, is that it facilitates a discussion exactly like this one, which is emphasizing the continued need for the Corridors of Commerce program, but also acknowledging that there's some work to do to get the program back on track and doing the best work and investing in projects like it had since its creation. Because the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities has supported the Corridors program since its creation in 2013, because in its relatively short history, It helped make some incredible progress on some of those long-awaited projects around the state, the type that, you know, whether it's Highways 14, 23, some of those projects where, regardless of age, you'll talk to locals and they'll say, we've been trying to get that done since before I was born. Those are the types of projects that finally some of them were able to start getting done. And a lot of that was as a result of investments made through the Corridors of Commerce program. So we do support a dedicated funding stream to the program. This particular bill, you know, has challenges in that, you know, it's structured to take existing our transportation resources and redirect them toward Corridors of Commerce. So, of course, that needs more discussion. It feels like, might feel to this committee like a little bit of deja vu from some of the other discussions this week on, you know, these vitally important transportation programs. How do we fund them? They deserve consideration, but we need to do that in a way that doesn't take from other parts of the system. But they do merit consideration for ongoing support. And I thank Representative Torkelson as well for putting out there the project readiness criteria, because as the committee's discussion already has illustrated, that's, I think, one important criteria that needs a look at. But the existing criteria and then maybe some others need to be at least discussed or refined as we go forward to make sure that the program can continue to be successful and invest in good projects. So, again, thank you. This was a unique position for me as a testifier to go after some of the member discussion and respond to a few things. I actually like it, though, for what it's worth, because I think we've had a great discussion here, exactly what I think this bill is meant to facilitate, and I'll leave it at that. I'll hang on the line for questions, but thank you again, and thank you for your work.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zart. Any questions of Mr. Zart? Representative Bernardi.
Mr. Chair, I just have a comment about the bill, so I can wait until that point in time.
Okay, let's hear from Mr. Rudin briefly, and then we'll have your comment, Representative Bernardi, and then we'll move on with the rest of our agenda. Mr. Rudin, welcome to the committee, and I think you've already stated your name for the record, so but please proceed with your more formal testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson and committee members. Again, Eric Rudin, MEDEC Government Affairs, and we do have some concerns with the legislation. First would be the funding mechanism that's proposed in this bill. And then secondly, some of the issues that we've seen with the program overall, as we've been discussing here already. So, you know, dedicating 10% of existing trunk highway funds to the program really means that either the state road construction would see a substantial impact if all the impacts were concentrated there, or conversely, you know, we could see it sort of an across-the-board impact across all the activities that are funded out of the Trunk Highway Fund. If that was the case, you know, we would see things like maintenance operations, you know, purchasing snowplows, salts, and de-icing materials, the ability to do pavement maintenance, guardrail and cable median barriers, repairs that would all be impacted, you know, if we redirected existing funds out of the maintenance program into Corridors of Commerce. If all of the impacts were borne in the state road construction program, you know, this would mean less funding for bridges, pavements, things like noise walls, rail grade projects, right of way acquisition, you know, things that are already programmed in the four-year STIP and planned in the 10-year CHIP. We would have to redirect funding from those activities. It could also make it challenging to match federal funds. We use our state funds, of course, to match federal construction dollars, and you know, it looks like Congress might be on the verge of doing something to increase funding for construction at the federal level. So that could be another challenge. One other issue to highlight is that the way that we're interpreting the bill, it appears that funds would need to be encumbered or if not expended by the end of each two-year biennial budget period. And that would be a challenge because there's a solicitation process, scoring process. Frequently, these tend to be complex projects. And so, you know, it can take months just to do the solicitation and scoring and then trying to develop the project and get it to a point where it's ready to be let would be a challenge as well. So we've learned that, you know, we really do need some more time to develop these projects that are submitted. Many of them have had really no design or engineering work done. And so, as Representative Torkelson mentioned, it's been difficult to predict those costs when that work hasn't occurred. And, you know, I'd point out too that regardless of what criteria we set up for project selection, and regardless of the funding level for Corridors of Commerce, not every project is going to be funded. And so, you know, there are going to be folks who are unhappy that their project was not selected. Just a couple closing comments here. You know, Representative Hausman asked about the regional balance, and I think that would be one area where we would really welcome legislative input, because that is not spelled out in the statute today. And so we use the traditional, you know, metro area versus the rest of the state to define that regional balance. But we did try to alert the legislature that that meant projects that were on the edge of the metro area would likely score better. And that was in fact what happened in 2018. So, you know, if regional balance means sort of the four corners of the state or a project in every MnDOT district or whatever regional balance, you know, means to the legislature, we would really welcome some clarification of that in statute. And then, we have discovered as well that, you know, if we're in doing a Corridors of Commerce project, the public expects us to do pavement work, drainage work, other work while we're in there impacting traffic. And that typically has not been submitted as part of the Corridors of Commerce applications. And then finally, Mr. Chair, I'll just point out that really the program is fully committed through 2026. And so, the existing bond appropriations that were provided, we have projects that are planned, that are on the books, that are in the development stage. Some of them are already under construction, like Highway 14, but the program is committed through 2026, and it would be extremely challenging if, you know, funding was provided and had to be obligated by the end of fiscal 2023 for us to be able to do that. So, thanks for that opportunity, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to take more questions if there are any.
Thanks very much, Mr. Houdin. And I think, again, I just, given the member questions and the public testimony and some of your thoughts, Mr. Houdin, and this is exactly why we wanted to have this hearing. I think there is a lot to go over. There's not only funding issues, there's criteria. You have some interesting suggestions that are worthy of consideration. And I'm very committed, Representative Torkelson, to continue to work with you on, you know, taking a look at this program and making adjustments as needed. Our last comment will be from Representative Bernardi, who wants to speak to the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just want to, I appreciate MnDOT's testimony on this bill. I want to just reiterate the importance of us maintaining and fixing our transportation system that we currently have. So just think of fix it first. And this bill guts the program that's been established to do that the best we can, being that we have a huge hundreds of millions of dollars of gap in the need of our current system. So I just want to put a plug in, let's work together to get the needed funding for our entire transportation system before we gut our program to do expansion. We need to focus on fix first until we have necessary funding for expansion by dedicating these funds to that purpose.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Good point. And we'll have a Representative Elkins, is your hand up? Is this a new point? Okay, very quickly, Representative Elkins, and then we'll wrap up. Representative Elkins.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torres, the comment I would like to add to that is if we raided the STIP to fund a new round of Corridors of Commerce, one of the ironic outcomes of that is it would probably delay the completion or the funding of projects that are currently now in the STIP that were funded out of the last round of Corridors of Project. It would take away the marginal money for projects like 35W 494 or 494 project that are now pretty much all designed and ready to go, but do need money that money from the STIP to complete them.
Another good point, Representative Elkins. Representative Torkelson, quick summary comments, and again, appreciate your bringing this forward.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add that Corridors was created, I think, and from my perspective anyway, as a way to get projects funded that otherwise weren't moving forward but had a lot of legislative support. I'm not an earmark guy. I don't think earmarks are appropriate, although there's always an effort to create new earmarks every biennium. At the same time, our STIP and SHIP programs, which I had, are great programs and very well run, tend not to be able to fund large projects. So there's a number of cross currents here. It's my hope that a redesigned Corridors of Commerce would allow for reasonable legislative input in project identification, and that it would set important projects on the road to proper evaluation and eventually funding for projects that are really have broad support on the side of the legislature's perspective. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for hearing this bill, and thank you for your offer of cooperation. I do intend to continue my work to try and bring Corridors to a relevant position in Minnesota transportation funding. You know, building legislative support is a way to build a chance for us to make sure that we get more resources committed to transportation. When we alienate legislators and their issues regarding transportation projects, we also alienate a certain amount of support. So kind of a cross current here that I think is really important that I pledge to continue my work to try and forward.
Thank you so much, Representative Torkelson, and your work is appreciated. And I think, again, this program was conceived, you know, 8 years ago to really address some of the voids in, you know, ensuring that some of these long delayed corridors, you know, were able to get some support that are needed. But again, like everything else, these things sometimes take on a life of their own and may have unintended consequences from, you know, their initiation. So I think we both agree on that, Representative Torkelson, and appreciate your work on this. So members, we're going to lay over. I had the wrong House file. It's House File 958, and we'll lay that over for possible inclusion and certainly more discussion. So thank you, members. This was really very helpful to have this conversation. Now we're going back to bills that are in the committee for re-referral to other committees. And our next bill is House File 41. Representative Frazier, welcome. I believe this is your first foray into the Transportation Committee, and we welcome you. I will move that House File 41 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy. Welcome, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that motion was a mouthful, but I appreciate you moving it forward. And glad to be here. Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 41 is pretty straightforward. It provides for emergency leave for COVID-related issues. The reason this bill is important is because many of you, as all of you are aware, last year, the federal government passed the Families First Coronavirus Act, and that act covered and it provided 2 weeks of leave for COVID-related issues. However, it also provided some exemptions from that, and this bill will capture those individuals that were left out based on that exemptions. For example, the exemptions covered businesses that were above 500 employees or healthcare hospitals, essentially, as well, could exempt from participating in this program. Not all did exempt from participating in this program, but some did. And so to that extent, we're trying to capture those frontline workers that were there day in and day out, helping to keep keep us moving forward, to help keep us safe, but were not covered by this leave, which means they did not have the ability to take time off with guaranteed pay if they were exposed to COVID, just in order to protect themselves and protect their family and also protect their coworkers. we've been to several committees now, and some of the questions that have come up is, why is this bill retroactive? Well, it's retroactive because for individuals that had to take time off to burn through their PTO, vacation time, or other sick leave, we want to make sure we get those individuals back to where they were. They lost out. They should not have. They are our essential workers. We should treat them like our essential workers. We want to take care of them. There's also concern about, is this an unfunded mandate? Well, for businesses that are 500 employees or less, there is still a government tax credit, dollar for dollar, to cover much of what the expenses would be to cover this this paid leave. And that extension has been included in the rescue plan, the American Rescue Plan that was just signed into law, to extend until September 30th. So the bottom line is, we have essential workers that are working hard on the front lines to help protect us and help us keep us moving forward during this COVID pandemic challenge. And we want to make sure we take care of those essential workers. That's what this bill is for, and I hope to get support.
Thank you so much for bringing this forward, Representative Frazier. And I believe there are a couple of, they're not testifiers, but we do have people available for questions. So I think we're going to go right to questions from the committee to the author and potentially others. Representative Petersburg.
Make sure I get unmuted and everything. So is there any fiscal cost here? I mean, I guess that is the question that I have. Is there a fiscal note? Is there some dollars that we need to be aware of the cost? How will this impact things? You know, we're hearing from chambers and others that they're not really in support of this bill. So I'm curious as to know, you know, what are the negative sides of this bill as well as what cost might be there?
Representative Petersburg, I think if it's okay, Representative Frazier, would you want us to call on Andy Lee from our House fiscal staff for that one?
Mr. Chair, I would appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Lee, maybe you could go through the fiscal note. I mean, this bill, it was heard, and just to give folks a little bit of perspective, I mean, it was heard in state government finance, we're discussing the potential impact this bill has on the transportation budget. That's why it's here, and particularly the state patrol. So I just wanted to give people, the context for the bill in our committee. And Mr. Lee, if you could respond to Representative Petersburg's question.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. So first on the fiscal note, the House File 41 was amended in the State Government Committee 2 days ago. So there's a new request for a fiscal note to conform to the amendments that were put out in state government. Unfortunately, the fiscal note isn't done yet, and that's because it includes most state agencies. So I'm reading off of a preliminary fiscal note that has not yet been approved by the LBO. But it's specific to the Department of Public Safety relative to the Transportation Committee. So as mentioned earlier, the impact relative to the Transportation Committee area is largely to the State Patrol. Those are considered essential workers. And in the preliminary fiscal note assumptions, and I should note this is preliminary and not yet signed off by the LBO, they assume that 25% of eligible State Patrol FTEs would use these 80 hours. And as a result, there would be need for overtime for covering shifts. And because the State Patrol is funded by a combination of the Trunk Highway Fund, the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and the General Fund, there would be a split in those costs. So the preliminary fiscal note estimates that the overtime cost to the Trunk Highway Fund, and this is just in fiscal 2021, one time, would be $1.166 million in trunk highway cost, $11,000 in highway user tax distribution fund cost, and $100,000 in general fund cost. And that $100,000 is relative to the State Patrol presence at the Capitol, the U.S. General Fund. And in addition, there was a $35,000 estimated cost for the alcohol gambling enforcement division in DPS that falls outside the committee jurisdiction, but that's another DPS cost. So, to stress, this is a preliminary fiscal note, but those were what DPS submitted to the LBO as their estimated costs for House File 41.
Representative Petersburg, did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I'll have one more follow-up for sure, and then I'll let other people talk, and maybe I'll bring up some others. But it sounds to me like right now we're dealing with it because it deals with government entities that were underneath our jurisdiction. I'm assuming that this would also apply for the potential for county and state, other state agencies as well. And so it does seem, I know that's outside of our jurisdiction, but it does seem like those agencies have their own agreements with personnel, et cetera, for that. So it's just, I'm just trying to wrap my head around, you know, why it's being brought forth when it seems like it's primarily focused towards government entities. But that's my thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. I don't know if Representative Frazier, you wanted to respond to that. I mean, again, I want to emphasize that, you know, we're here specifically to talk about the fiscal implications for the state patrol, which is under our jurisdiction. You know, obviously, I agree with Representative Frazier's perspective on this and the need to have this paid time. I think this was an issue before COVID. It's certainly an issue now, particularly. And so that, I think, you know, that's why I think overall it's for us and before us. But, you know, our jurisdiction is, I mean, we have state employees in general, but the state patrol in particular. Are there some additional questions from the committee? Otherwise, we could go back to revert back to Representative Petersburg's additional question or two. Trying to see here, I'm scanning the, I don't see any additional questions. Now, Representative Petersburg, you mentioned that you had a couple more, or at least one more.
There, I finally got unmuted. Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay.
Yes, I do. So this is kind of one of those tricky things where I see us trying to juggle a lot of different items here. And so, as you know, we've had a lot of debate on the floor, as well as in other agencies and other, committees about the hit that all of the executive orders and the COVID has had to business in general in trying to stay afloat and trying to stay up with making sure that they're able to stay in business. And my question is this seems like it's kind of unfunded mandates to them, in which I think it's just one more burden that they're going to have to try to overcome with it as well. So how do we balance that need with the concern that we are now putting businesses in one more negative situation, in which either we're going to have to kind of reimburse them for, or we're going to have to ask them to lose more dollars and try to make it up later through other labor negotiations, et cetera, which always happens. I mean, a benefit doesn't come without some sort of cost. And so the question is, what will this do into the future? Is this indeed an unfunded mandate? How does the agencies come up with those extra funds that in which it's government? Those are just questions that I don't see answered in this particular bill.
Okay, well, you know, Representative Frazier, did you want to address those questions? I think much of that revolved around unfunded mandates and impacts on businesses. But Representative Frazier, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg, thank you for those questions. I think those are good questions. And when you read through the bill, it does kind of get to addressing that. Well, for one, the American Rescue Plan will help cover some of these costs moving forward. There is still a tax credit benefit dollar for dollar to cover this leave, and that will extend to September 30th for the new 80 hours that is provided. There was a tax benefit. It was paid for prior to that by the feds for state and local governments that provided these resources. So that will be covered for small businesses, 500 or less. The same, those tax credits apply. So they'll have the ability to have those benefits paid for with those tax credits. And I will just say, I totally understand what you're saying about the moment that we're in, the burden and pressure that has been on some of our businesses. But what I do want to think, we have to think about the workers that have been burdened by the work that they've had to do during and still currently in the midst of this pandemic. They have bore the brunt of coming in and day out, putting themselves in harm's way to make sure those businesses can stay open and provide the services that they provide. So I want to make sure that we keep centering around the workers that have already paid the cost throughout this pandemic.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Petersburg, did you have one more follow-up or are you?
Not really, other than just saying, so sick leave is one of those things in which we're giving into the past, where in reality, sick leave is supposed to be generated for when you have actually need, because of your illness, to be able to take those. And that's something that has always been negotiated through labor negotiations. And so I just have some problem with state mandating that, because I don't think government should be involved in employee relations. That's just my own opinion. So thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a philosophical question that we will debate for a long time. And I just appreciate your willingness to hear this bill as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see any additional questions from the committee. Representative Frazier, did you want to make any closing comments before we vote?
Just quickly, again, I'll go back to centering this conversation around the workers that have been there on the front line providing services to us to make sure we can still have access to essential services, but also putting themselves on the line day in and day out. And I just want to make sure we take care of those workers.
Thank you very much. And thank you for bringing this bill. Note of appreciation from me on that. I see no further discussion. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 41 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Criminal Justice Reform, Finance and Policy Committee. With that, would Mr. Dodge please take the roll?
Chair Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Vice Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, nay. Representative Barr?
No.
Barr, nay. Representative Bernardi? Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins?
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hausman?
Aye.
Hausman, aye. Representative Heinrich?
No.
Heinrich, nay. Representative Kosnick?
No.
Kosnick, nay. Representative Mason?
Aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Murphy?
Murphy, aye.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
No.
Olson, nay. Representative Richardson? Representative Richardson? Representative Richardson? Representative Torkelson?
No.
Torkelson, nay. Representative West?
West, no.
West, nay. There are 9 ayes and 7 nays.
Okay, there being 9 ayes and 7 nays, House File 41 is re-referred, and I'm just going to say the committee. Representative Frazier, thank you so much for this bill and bringing it forward, and we wish you luck in your continued committee stops for House File 41.
Thank you.
Great. So thank you, members. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 2126, Representative Zhang. And welcome to the committee, Representative Zhang. I will move that House File 2126 be re-referred to the General Register. And please proceed with your testimony to the bill.
He may have lost him for a moment there, Mr. Chair.
Okay, because I think he was with us earlier.
Yeah, he was there.
We'll wait a moment or two for Representative Zhang to reconnect.
Should be joining now.
Okay. Representative Zhang, are you with us?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Oh, great. Thank you. No, that's okay. We are. This is so common here in the Zoom era. No worries whatsoever. Representative Zhang, I just wanted to welcome you to the Transportation Committee, and I will just restate my motion that House File 2126 be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair.
Please proceed with your bill testimony.
Chair and members, House File 2126, it's a bill that is to broaden the disclosure of motor vehicle crash reports produced by law enforcement officers following a collision, which are generally limited to a specified set of circumstances. You know, under this change, the Department of Public Safety or any sort of law enforcement agency must disclose the report on request of a local prosecutor that is involved in an implied consent case with a traffic or criminal offense that has been identified as a result of the crash investigation by law enforcement. And with me here to answer any questions is from the Department of Public Safety. I have with me, let's see here, a staff member from the Department of Public Safety that's also available here for any questions for members.
Sure. I think we have Mr. Hansen, I believe. Yep. Is Mr. Hansen on the call?
Mr. Chair, I am, sir.
Okay. Well, did you want to make some comments about House File 2126?
Mr. Chair and members, certainly. I will keep my remarks very brief. I know you have a packed agenda, and I would just like to thank Representative Zhang for bringing this forward. The legislation proposal that you have in front of you is basically a technical correction to Statute 16909, Subdivision 13. Under current interpretation, there are only limited numbers of individuals or entities that are entitled to the MnCrash traffic crash report form that law enforcement generates anytime they're called to investigate a collision. And it's one of the only forms and the only reports that I'm aware of that the prosecutor in a criminal case does not have access to. The prosecutor would have access to the data, but in order for the prosecutor to get that data, it has to be translated into a second report off of the MnCrash form itself. Now, I've done some research working with my partners at Driver and Vehicle Services and the State Patrol and so forth. And from what I can understand, this goes back to about a 1940 recodification of the traffic code. And at that time, the intent of the crash report that law enforcement prepared was strictly for data and analysis and prevention purposes. As law enforcement as a profession has progressed, and as the information contained on these police-generated crash reports has improved, much of the information that is contained on that crash report form is critical to a prosecutor when they're preparing a traffic or a criminal case as a result of a collision. And so, in the current format, anytime a trooper, officer, or deputy takes that enforcement action following that investigation, they need to prepare a separate report, a duplicate report that has that critical information that the prosecutor needs. So it creates a great deal of duplication and additional time and resources to complete that. But perhaps just as importantly, or if more importantly, if that enforcement action is not taken, then the innocent drivers who are simply in the wrong place at the wrong time when somebody else either makes a mistake or does something behind the wheel that causes that collision, they don't have any victims' rights that vest with them. And so they're left with very little recourse as far as being made whole again following a collision that is not their fault at all. Now, one of the questions that I've received is, well, would a defense attorney have access to the same report form? And under the current statute, yes, they would, because the defendant in these cases would already have access to that report form, and legal counsel for the defendant, because they are a participant in that crash, would also have access to that report form. So again, it's the statute has been amended a couple of times in order to allow MnDOT access to it, those report forms, so that they can recover damages to their property as a result of these crashes. So we're just simply asking for some streamlining that will save law enforcement and prosecutors a great deal of duplication, and will further the judicial process to hold drivers accountable for bad behavior or mistakes that constitute a traffic or a criminal offense. And with that, sir, I'd be happy to stand for any questions that members may have.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. And we do have a question from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but just a form of support. I've read the bill before, and it makes sense that the prosecutor should have the information that's being generated anyway. No sense in duplicating it. It benefits no one. And so I appreciate Representative Zhang for bringing it forward, and now I'd encourage support of the bill as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, thank you for those comments, Representative Petersburg. Is there any questions or discussion to the House file, or questions to the author or to Mr. Hansen? Okay, I don't see any. So with that, members, Representative Zhang, did you want to say anything in conclusion before we vote?
I just really appreciate DPS bringing this up to me and helping walk through this, and hope you all can support this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Zhang, and thank you for bringing it forward. Members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2126 be re-referred to the General Register. Mr. Dodge, please take the roll.
Chair Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Vice Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Aye.
Petersburg, aye. Representative Barr?
Aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins?
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Houseman?
Aye.
Houseman, aye. Representative Heinrich?
Aye.
Heinrich, aye. Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Kosnick, aye. Representative Mason?
Aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Murphy?
Murphy, aye.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Torkelson? Representative Torkelson? Representative West?
West, aye.
West, aye. There are 16 ayes and 0 nays.
There being 16 ayes and 0 nays, the House File 2126 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you very much, Representative Zhang, and we look forward to hearing this bill on the floor. Members, we have one more bill, that is House File 381 that is now before us. We have the chair of the Agriculture and Veterans Committee, Representative Sundin, with us. Representative Sundin, welcome back to the Transportation Committee. You're a veteran of this committee. Many terms you were on this committee, and we miss you, but we're glad to see you again. And I am going to move that House File 381 is laid over for possible inclusion here in our bill. So there is a DE1 amendment. Did you want to incorporate that first, Representative Sundin? You know, I have to expand my view here so I can see who's...
If someone would move the DE1, I will talk about it.
Okay. Representative Sundin, I'll move the DE1 amendment, and why don't we hear from you about it, and then we'll take a vote on it. Representative Sundin, welcome back to the Transportation Committee.
Thank you very much. The DE1 is essentially the bill. We've worked on this for a few years, and I think we finally found success with the help of the Minnesota Association of County Veterans Service Officers, and this is, they tuned up the language for us, and I think all the parties are very satisfied with this language.
Okay, so members, this is the bill in the form that the author would like us to consider it in. Any questions or discussion about the DE1? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All of those opposed, the motion prevails, and we do have House File 381 as amended before us to the bill, Chairman Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. This is a nice little bill offered up, brought forth by a public servant in Cloquet, Minnesota. Mr. James Langenbrenner, who served as a fireman for his career in city of Cloquet and also as a National Guardsman. And after service in the National Guard, he realized that the identification that is available for many veterans on their driver's licenses was not available for him as a retired Guard member. And that identification actually entitles veterans, current veterans and retired veterans to access to military facilities, airport rest areas for the veterans, any and all benefits requiring proof of military service. And this actually is a conformity or matches up at least with the federal identification. Minnesota's just catching up. And I thank James Langenbrenner for bringing this up. As I mentioned, the Minnesota Association of County Veterans have suggested language. It's in the bill that, firstly, it requires payment of the required fee by the applicant for this, and describes the forms of identification that would allow the veterans' designation to go on the driver's licenses. Typically, it's the DD-214, and the bill states, or other official discharge papers that describes the honorable service of the veteran. And that's important to remember that last part of the sentence that says, or other official discharge papers, because some of the veterans going back into the Korean War theater really had no access for identification here as well. So as the bill reads, this cleans up the language and expands this eligibility to Guard members and Korean War veterans. That's about it. As I mentioned, we've stumbled on this bill a few times, and we finally got clarification from the Minnesota Association of County Veterans Service Officers, and I thank Greg Peterson of that organization, the president of that organization, for his help on this bill. And that is about it.
Thanks so much, Chairman Sundin, and thanks for your work on this over a number of years. Members, we've had a series of these bills related to IDs, and of course that's in our committee because of the interface with driver and vehicle services. So we have a couple of questions or comments. First on the list is Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm currently an active reserve member, and every time I go to some form of training, that is an active situation, I have to receive a DD-214 to be released from active duty. So when I was 22 years old, I went to basic officers leadership course and I received a DD-214 that said I am honorably being discharged from active duty. Would that entitle me to this identification at the age of 22, having served 100? It was a little over 111 days of active duty service that I had to be released from. I think there was an amendment said something about conforming to the current, the definition that it is currently. I think it's adapting that, but I just wanted to make sure that that would not be the case, that a 22-year-old who has not been overseas, who just completed their initial basic training to become an officer, would not be able to get this identification.
Representative Sundin, if you want to answer that, that would be fine. Also, we have Ms. Andrea Fassbender from Driver and Vehicle Services.
I'll defer to Andrea Fassbender, please.
Okay, Ms. Fassbender, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. My name is Andrea Fassbender. I'm the Driver Services Director with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Could you repeat the question again? I'm sorry.
So would it have been possible for me, reservists, every time they're released from training, a training situation that was any lengthy period of time, they get a DD-214, releases them from active duty. So when I was 22 years old, having gone to basic officers leadership course, having accomplished nothing to gain me any title whatsoever of a veteran, they provided me a DD-214 that said, Second Lieutenant Christian Olson, that's my first name, has been released from active duty and it was an honorable discharge. Would that provide me with the ability to qualify under this new statute to receive the identification card with the veteran status on there?
Under with the you're talking about the
Ms. Fassbender.
Sorry, Chair. Would that be the way the language is current written, correct?
So I think there's an amendment in there that says that it conforms back to what it currently is. And what it currently is requires 181 days. Is that accurate? So it's still gonna state that purpose? Nothing.
Yeah. Ms. Fassbender.
Yeah. Correct, Chairman, members of committee, correct. So currently, that's the way it's worded, if you do have to show that you have 180 consecutive days of active duty military service to qualify for to put the veterans indicator on your credential. That is correct.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Olson?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted some clarification for that because Second Lieutenant Olson did not deserve veteran status at the age of 22, having just completed basic officer's leadership. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Olson. We have Representative Heinrich and then Representative Hausman. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Sundin for bringing this bill forward and helping out our vets. I am also a veteran with multiple DD-214s. I originally signed up for the reserves here out of Fort Snelling with the Marine Corps. In 2003 and 2004, was active for a couple of years. And in total of an eight-year term, I was active duty for about 3.5 of that because we were deployed to Iraq and whatnot. So just want to really thank Representative Mike Sundin for this bill. I'm glad that you had a chance, Representative, to talk to MDVA and that you have the support of Minnesota Association of County Veteran Services Officers as well. So thanks for checking in with those guys and so we can feel good about supporting this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heinrich. And we have Representative Hausman and then Representative Petersburg after that. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if our House researcher would have a different answer to Representative Olson, because when I read that language, it sounded as though it says they don't any longer have to be required to have 181 days.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I reached that same conclusion under the DE-1 amendment as opposed to the language of the bill as introduced. So the DE-1 amendment has a couple of modifications. So there are sort of two sets of possible requirements that the applicant would have to meet. One is be a veteran, which does have that 181 days of service requirement. And then the second that's being added is somebody could be a current or former National Guard member or member of a reserve component of U.S. Armed Forces and have the proper documentation. But the other piece of that requirement is that the person would have to have honorably completed the first full term of service. And that's the piece I'm not quite sure on how that aspect would be interpreted or administered by the department. And that might be something that the department would need to investigate a little bit further to determine how that threshold is.
Well, let's do our best to sort this out here in our time remaining. Ms. Fassbender, did you want to respond to what Mr. Burris had to say?
Chairman, members of the committee, sorry about that. I misunderstood the question if it was the amendment was included. So we would actually have to reach out for that second part Mr. Burris was referencing related to the interpretation of completion of the service. We would actually reach out to our source of information is Minnesota Veterans Affairs. We'd probably reach out to them and make sure that our interpretation would match what Minnesota would consider that completion of service.
So thank you, Ms. Fassbender. So just, it's important to know that, you know, we're working off that DE1 and, you know, this is an important question that deserves some clarification. I see Representative Petersburg has his hand up. I see you also have your hand up. So we have about 4 minutes left and then we do want to vote on this bill today. So Representative Petersburg, then Representative Heinrich, and we'll take this to a vote. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, I think the last time I looked, this doesn't have a Senate companion, which that doesn't matter.
Go ahead, sorry.
That doesn't matter as much, except that, you know, I would also like to see this bill move forward. And so I'm wondering, will there be one shortly? And is there a path forward in which it can actually get into law?
Just one clarification. I misspoke. You know, our motion was to lay this bill over for inclusion in the transportation omnibus bill. Sorry about that.
Okay.
So we will have some time to. Yeah, sorry.
Never mind.
We'll have time to sort through this issue if it needs additional clarification. So no rush here. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will go quick. I don't know if this is helpful or not, but I was just thinking, of course, when you after you go through training, you are issued a valid military ID, and a person would be able to certainly use that military ID to do things like get on base and access some services, and then, of course, possibly get a free breakfast at a restaurant or something like that if you show your military ID. So in one sense, and again, I might be wrong, but in one sense, I think that military ID of a active or reserve active status would probably trump whatever marking would be put on a license anyway. So again, I might be wrong, but thanks for the indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's really, thank you, Representative Heinrich. It's really good to get your perspective and Representative Olson's perspective on this. This is directly affecting you and certainly people that you know. So with that, members, I don't see any additional questions. We are laying this bill over. I'll renew that motion in just a second. But Representative Sundin, did you want to have any final comments to the committee?
Just quite briefly on the DE1 1.17 through 1.18, it also states states that the requirements for the designation on this, and it also says showing that the person has honorably completed the first term, the first full term of service. So those full terms vary if you're which branch of the service you're in and what you signed up for. But we'll thread the needle on this a little bit better going forward. And I appreciate the indulgence of the committee, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair Sundin. And again, this is another good reminder about the importance of sort of working through these bills and hearings. And we'll make adjustments as needed to this before we incorporate it into the omnibus. So with that, members, I just wanted to thank everybody for a good hearing today. And we are, I know there was some talk of having a hearing tomorrow. We will not be meeting tomorrow. No transportation meeting tomorrow. We will have a busy week. We will be meeting at our regular time on Tuesday and Thursday. We are still working with House Information Services. It's likely we'll have at least one extra meeting, potentially one of the evenings, Tuesday and Thursday. Next week, but we'll be getting back to you on that. So watch your email. And with that, have a good weekend, everybody. And this meeting is adjourned.